Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Liaison Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jaakko Hammann, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, Growing Down: Theology and Human Nature in the Virtual Age. Jaakko, thanks for being willing to be part of this interview.
Chris, thank you. I feel honored. Thanks.
The world is awash in communications technologies, and sometimes it also seems to be awash in analyses of such technologies and what they're doing to the humans who've created them, yet also seem to be enslaved by them. How is your book different from these other analyses?
Chris, yes, I do believe that much is being written about our relationship with technology. What makes my project different is that I finally figured out that maybe the question we need to ask is not the question about technology, and especially not so much the impact of technology on our brains, for instance, or things like that, even though neuroscience is important. But I figured out that the question we need to ask is one of human nature. The question is not, is the next iPhone 5 times faster than the previous one? That's not the question. The question is, how is human nature impacted by technology? How does technology draw on aspects of human nature for its own success? And so in my book, I draw upon object relations theory, a post-Freudian psychology, to describe human nature in many ways, and I show how technology sort of taps into these aspects of human nature, which both then feels very natural to us on many levels, but then at the same time, it may tap into something that feels so natural, but it may not be good for us long term, or it may undermine our well-being in significant ways. So in my book, I draw on object relations theories, sociology, anthropology, neuroscience, even a little bit of economics, to argue that the real question is, who are we as human beings who are using technology, rather than focusing on technology and its impact on us?
One of the central images in your book is actually the main title, Growing Down. And to me, the word immediately evokes the concept of growing up. And it also brings to mind a picture of a plant extending itself into the earth. So what do you mean by growing down, and what are the roots, no pun intended, for that terminology?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that if you hear growing down, you think in terms of growing up. Now, we know from all kinds of research that children's engagement with technology actually accelerates maturity, so that we now have kids who are chronologically 12 years of age, but emotionally they react as 15 and 16-year-olds. And the reason is technology exposed them to mature content way before they were emotionally ready for that exposure. And that kind of comes at a personal cost, which as adults typically we will have to figure out. But it comes at a cost. The growing down title then really wants to challenge a little bit the growing up theme and say we have to think of differently. But really, three people explicitly informed the concept of growing down. And the one is Donald Winnicott, D.W. Winnicott, the person I use extensively within the book and a key proponent in object relations theory. He famously said that a great deal of growing is growing downwards to become small enough to get through the little hole called dying. It's a wonderful way of saying that for most of us who will not be so lucky to have an instant death, we will, in old age probably, we will return to the vulnerability and the dependency almost the same kind of a community that we had in infancy, as other people will take care of us. And he said, how do you grow as an adult who can allow that kind of vulnerability and dependency? And I'm asking in my book, if we spend so much time with technology, will we grow into that kind of vulnerability? I'm not sure about that at the moment. A second person that I use to explore growing down is the renowned African-American philosopher and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, who right here in Nashville at Fisk University said in 1933 that the education of youth in a changing world is a puzzling problem. Instead of the university growing down and seeking to comprehend in its curriculum the life and experience, the thought and expression of lower classes, it almost invariably tended to grow up and narrow itself to a sublimated elite of mankind. For Du Bois, growing down is, are you a person who can relate to people at the margins of our society, who are at the bottom end of any ladder that you can conceive? And Du Bois said universities should actually help people discover the marginalized, the oppressed, the poor, those who experience social injustice. When universities want to help people to grow up and join the elite, the wealthy. And he really faulted African-American students, especially in his time, for joining the elite when they should be focusing more on poverty and the marginalized and the injustices that the African-American community sort of explores. And so another theme of my book then is technology helping us discovering the other, the marginalized, the oppressed, the poor? Is technology helping us to make a difference in those people's lives? Or do we feel that I can write a blog post and I can tweet and now I've made my difference? So those are some of the questions that I ask. And then a last person, James Hillman, a psychologist, right in his The Soul's Code, he writes about how the soul always likes to descend. It wants to go down rather than go up. And he says it takes a long time to get on our feet and to descend. We grow down, he says. So those are a couple of the references to growing down that I appreciated. And then I try to argue that it's in our human nature to actually be vulnerable, to be interdependent upon other people. It's in our human nature to solve injustices. And how is technology helping us to do that?
Another image that plays a significant part throughout your book and that addresses this whole idea of the development of our natures is the holding environment. So what is the holding environment? Where does this idea come from, and what is it, and how does it connect to our relationship with technology?
Yeah, Chris, the holding environment is a concept that comes from object relations theory. And it really describes in a very physical way the context or even the room that parents would create for their newborn infant. For instance, we know that we would create a room where there's no loud noises because that scares a baby. We would create a room that there's no bright lights because that will scare a baby. But the holding environment is this welcoming space that allows an infant who is so vulnerable to be nurtured, needs will be met. In this holding environment, there's a lot of touch. There's a lot of eye contact. There's a lot of togetherness. And I argue that handheld technology, by focusing so much on touch, by focusing so much on eye contact, is replicating in many ways this holding environment. how I deepen my argument is by saying that we know, for instance, that a baby cannot smile by him or herself. A baby smiles when you and I smile into that baby's face. So that the sense of self of an infant, other than issues of hunger and dirty diapers and things like that, but the sense of self is really determined by loving caregivers. That's what determines the sense of self. And I argue that technology today is probably the biggest impact on our sense of self. It determines our sense of self. This morning, if I would have been a couple of blocks down the road and I would have said, oh, I forgot my phone at home, I probably would have turned around to go home and pick it up.
Right.
And there was days where I have forgotten my phone at home, and you feel sort of unsettled the whole day. Because the environment that our handheld technology has created for us really does impact the sense of self. So holding environment, this metaphor that really speaks about early infancy and childhood, but I see that being replicated by technology that provides seemingly all our needs we can meet through technology nowadays.
The bulk of Growing Down is devoted to exploring six kinds of intelligences that you maintain are important for humans to cultivate and to deal with some of the issues that you've just been talking about. And those intelligences are self, relational, transitional, reparative, playground, and technological. Now, listeners are going to have to read the book to get the details, but I did want us at least to touch on aspects of each of these intelligences to give folks an idea of what they are and how they relate to our technology-saturated world. So, to begin with, self-intelligence. What is self-intelligence, and how does our devotion to communications technologies affect the development of this kind of intelligence?
Chris, yes, of course it was Harvard's Howard Gardner who put us onto intelligences many, many years ago, linguistic, spatial, bodily kinesthetic, musical, etc. And then Daniel Goleman came and he created emotional intelligence for us, and that went into boardrooms and corporate offices. And I was thinking as I wrote the book that I think those intelligences may not be as important in our virtual age where we spend so much time around technology. It's not that I think they've disappeared, but I think we need a new set of intelligences that can guide us around our use of technology. Self-intelligence then is a deep awareness of who you are as an I am, as a self. And in that chapter, I address a variety of moments. One, for instance, is the self's need to be physically held. That need does not disappear. It starts in infancy.
In this holding environment.
In this holding environment. But everybody wants to be held. And so then the question then is, if I only hold a phone in my hand, will that fill that need to be held? And I say no, and show on research that indicates that maybe the more you hold your phone in hand, the less relationships you have where you will be physically held. I address things such as phones putting us always in a reactive stance because they buzz and they beep and our phones ring. And what happens to the self if you are constantly reactive to something else, when I think health for the self is much more a proactive step that the self takes, but our technology puts us in a reactive space all the time. I address the self's need for transformation. That is, one of the most powerful forces I think that humanity brings is that we want to transform our sense of self. We want to feel differently, think differently, act differently, especially if we are in comfortable or painful places. And technology is a wonderful transformational agent then, because it does change the way we think and feel and act. I also address a concern such as sexuality, where human sexuality is a full-bodied sexuality. But we know, because of the prevalence of pornography, that sexuality has become very genitalized. And in a genitalized sexuality, nobody can thrive. Women are exploited most often, men too. But that is not the kind of sexuality or even sexual experience that gives joy in life. So self-intelligence, I think, is really key to try to figure out if we are emotional, for instance, another aspect of self-intelligence. If we are emotional beings, what do we do with the emotions that are stirred up by technology? If we see image upon image of an atrocity, for instance, or if we are inundated with certain messages and those emotions are awakened in our bodies, what happens to our bodies when that takes place? Self-intelligence, I think, is really a key component for us, because we do live in the age of the selfie, which kind of points us towards self-intelligence. Yeah.
As you've indicated in your answer about self-intelligence, we don't exist alone, but we're always in relation with others. And you define the second intelligence that you discuss, relational intelligence, as, quote, growing in the art of being in authentic, loving, caring, and ethical relationships with persons, and easygoing, balanced relationships with things, unquote. So such intelligence involves both facing the other in what you might call real presence, and being capable of being alone in the presence of others. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how one can be both appropriately together and appropriately alone, and what technology's effects might be on relational intelligence.
Do that, yeah. Technology has done wonders for relationships. My family live in Africa, and I FaceTime my mom at least 5 days a week, and the other 2 days of the week we speak by phone. But we have contact every day, and we've had that for, maybe 15 plus years now, where I moved from like a once a week call to a daily interaction of like 3 minutes. And I think it has deepened our relationship considerably. Because I only have to talk about today. I don't have to talk about tomorrow or yesterday. It's just today, which keeps us much more focused in our relationships. So technology is wonderful. It certainly beats 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I came to the U.S. and a letter took three weeks to go back and forth. I would much rather have the technology we have today. At the same time, we have come an awful long way in our relational lives. Facebook, slightly more than 10 years old. And in those 10 years, we've moved from friendships, as it was sort of traditionally understood, to Facebook friends, which is a different kind of a friendship. And now with Instagram and Pinterest and those, Twitter, we have followers. And we don't even use the language of friends anymore. The question is, how many followers do you have? So that all indicates shifts in our relational dynamics, how we understand relationships, etc. So you and I, we really do live a facial existence. The comment about a baby that I mentioned earlier, not being able to smile, what really happens is that the baby's mirror neurons gets triggered when there's eye contact. And then the mirror neurons help to mimic what the baby sees, but it also leads to the secretion of dopamine, which is sort of this natural opioid that makes us feel good and more relaxed. but also oxytocin, which gives us a hormone that gives us a deep sense of belonging. And we know that if I stare at a screen on my iPad or my phone, my mirror neurons are triggered, dopamine is released, as well as oxytocin is released. So my body makes me feel very close to whoever I'm engaging through my phone. But there is a qualitative difference between face-to-face encounters between people and just people who know each other over the internet, for instance. And so I'm wondering in that chapter just how is technology impacting relational life. One piece of research that I draw upon comes out of the University of Virginia that showed if a cell phone is placed on a table where people are talking, even if the phone is faced down, just that mere presence, the conversation will be impacted significantly. People are less likely to follow up with one another. So a lot of little monologues, but nobody follows up with the other person. Difficult topics probably will be avoided. And it's unlikely that the conversation will become confliction or tension-filled, as that piece of technology just moderates the conversation, really, that's happening around around the table. So I think technology impacts our relational life significantly, even as it makes relational life much easier in many kinds of ways. The central question I'm asking in that chapter is, how do you grow, to use the language of Martin Buber, how do you grow into a person who can be in I-thou relationships with others? We so easily stereotype people online. I can say nasty things, but because I don't see your reaction, I don't feel responsible, and I may even be on to the next victim already. So how do we cultivate, authentic, honest relationships that can sustain us for a lifetime? How can we do that? And then what role does technology play in sustaining maybe those relationships? But where does technology also hinder us? Which I think it can do.
You talk about self, you talk about other or relationships, and then you talk about a space between self and other, and an intelligence associated with that, which you call transitional intelligence. And among other things, you locate things like creativity and boredom in this transitional space. So what makes for transitional intelligence, and how do you see technology impinging on these spaces of creativity and boredom?
So you're a librarian, and you will use the language often of, I've been pulled in by a book. We use the same language when we go to a movie or to a music concert or something like that, that something happened between me and the book or me and the music that I've been hearing or me and the movie. And that speaks to the transitional intelligence that I'm referring to, that something is happening between my subjectivity, me, and either another person, another subjectivity, or an object out there. And we know that that kind of a space that's between objects originate early in life, and it probably comes from the first time when a baby sucks his or her thumb to soothe and self-soothe. And that is then taken into soft toys or Linus had his blankie, you know, that he dragged around. But something happens between us and an object, and that really is what transitional intelligence is all about. And so I argue that technology can be a wonderful tool for creativity. For instance, using a camera on your phone, you can take wonderful pictures. It comes with software preloaded that you can manipulate the image, and that is great. There's lots of room for creativity within within technology, but at the same time, technology can also diminish creativity because I may just copy somebody else's creativity, and then I'm not practicing my own creativity. And I have seen that even with my own daughters, who they want to do something to their room, and rather than trying to figure out what they want to do to their room, they look at rooms in Pinterest until they find one that they like, and then they try to copy, you know, what they've seen. Now, that's a different kind of creativity that you use there. I'm thinking of the kind of creativity of standing in front of a clean canvas, and you're kind of anxious in terms of how to make that first stroke and where to begin and what will come forward from the canvas. So boredom is really important to us because when we are bored, creativity typically steps in to solve us from boredom. And we see that especially in kids again, where out of boredom, they may pick up a toy and they will begin to play with the toy, for instance. But what happened with us is that handheld technology all but killed boredom. You know, crossing here at Vandy, crossing the road between the parking garage and our building, there is often a light you have to wait a while to become your pedestrian light, and just about everybody goes on their phones immediately. But you can see that when people stop at a red light or even at a stop street, those milliseconds that they have to just observe their neighborhood, to see what's going on around them, they'll immediately go to their phone. And so I'm kind of concerned because one of the ways that spirituality flourishes is the ability to practice solitude. And solitude means that you can just sit with yourself for a while. And I'm wondering, how will solitude be practiced if being with ourself is so uncomfortable? You know, that we constantly need music in our ears, or we constantly need a screen to finger. So creativity, I think, is a wonderful gift for us. And certainly technology makes wonderful creativity possible, but at the same time, if we don't do the work of creativity, we may just be mimicking other people's creativity. We may just be copycats, and I think that diminishes our human nature. I really believe that.
So when something goes wrong in the relationships that we have with ourselves and with others, how do we deal appropriately with those kinds of disruptions? And I think that's where your the concept of reparative intelligence comes in. And how does technology help or hinder those attempts at reparation?
Yeah. The one thing that I think is true for every person, Chris, is that we carry wounds. We carry hurts that we received from loved ones and other people. We have experienced traumatic moments. And so I think a core intelligence we need today is reparative intelligence, which basically says, be responsive to the hurts that you carry so that they don't impinge upon you in negative ways, because they will. At the same time, how do you grow into a person that will make a difference in this world by helping the reparation of other people, of communities, our larger society? Definitely, how do we repair the earth that we know we are destroying quite aggressively at the moment? How do you grow into a caring person who's concerned about well-being? And I think that technology can help us on many platforms. For instance, as we have this interview, you know, we had a couple of hurricanes that hit the U.S. and Puerto Rico. People can see the images. They can donate money. That's wonderful. There was a mass killing in Las Vegas. Similar dynamic can unfold. So technology can really help us in many ways, but we also know of internet bullying, internet trolls. We can do such mean things online. And as I've said earlier, I think it's because we don't see the other person's face that we can say these mean things. And so how can we empower ourselves to be caring throughout? We know from research that, this comes out of the University of Michigan, that they have tracked their incoming students for about 20 years. And they track them along many markers, also the markers that speaks to empathy. And they have found that in their first year class, the markers for empathy has dropped by 40%. And the researchers have only one reason, really, why, and they say that it's technology. Technology makes you basically myopic, closed to the well-being of other people. I think if I've seen, you know, how many images of people drowning in the Mediterranean, trying to get out of Syria, but the one image is just replaced by another image the next day. Very few people actually go and try to make a difference. And society seems to have a little bit of apathy. The world definitely has apathy towards that cause. So reparative intelligence, I think, is just really important. And I appreciate Sherry Turkle, the MIT scholar, who has followed our relationship with technology for almost 30 years. And she says, if you text, "I am sorry," that it's a missed opportunity. Because there's probably much more conversation that needs to take place. There's much more learning that you may have to discover in the process. And just a mere text of saying, "I'm sorry," that probably is not enough.
Right. Now, you've done a good bit of work on the importance of play for human well-being. Excuse me. So it's not terribly surprising that there would be an intelligence associated with play. And you talk about play in both positive and negative guises. You call the latter, the negative, corrupted play. And you also bring up the notion of being played, which I found quite interesting. In a world where video games of all kinds are extremely popular and where we even have a word, gamification, to describe the ways in which aspects of gaming have been applied in non-gaming contexts. And gaming is not all of play, but it's an aspect. What is play, and how can playing and being played be carried out with playground intelligence?
Yeah, as you said, I deeply appreciate the formative capacity of play in our lives, and more than anything, I believe that we are homo ludens. We are persons at play. That's who we are. Play helps us to be not only creative, but to solve problems, and it does so much for us. And now with technology, we have unlimited potential for play. Video games and various forms of play. But the problem with play, Chris, is that play is difficult to define. And most play theorists do not define play at all, actually, but try to give a trait. Mm-hmm. One trait would be that play suspends time. And you and I have experienced that when we've had friends over for dinner. And so here it would be the play of hospitality and the play of conversation. And somebody would ask, "So what's the time?" Mm-hmm. And then somebody will say, "Well, it's 11 p.m. already." And then the third person will say, "Well, where did the time go?" You know. And so we know about the power of play. When we look at video games, though, play takes on the importance of deeper discernment for us. For instance, we know that the most popular video games are almost always first-person shooter games, where the sole purpose is to be as destructive as you possibly can be. And so a question that we have to ask is, what's the impact of that. Now, that is a very contentious area of research because it's not linear. It's not, I play a violent video game and I'll do a violent act. It's not a linear relationship. But I do think it's naive to say that that I can engage these games without being impacted in some way, and probably to a negative or critical side. We know from research out of pornography, for instance, that the mind gets bored with the same image. So a person who will start with sort of very basic pornography will end up with significant sort of fetishes and things like that in no time, because the mind gets bored with the same image and is always looking for new stimulation. So we know from pornography that we are impacted in significant ways by that technology. And so I am really sort of curious about how technology impacts us as persons. The being played is something that has always been part of play behavior. The first time you were in the context of playing and being played were probably around the age of 6 months to 8 months. You had a spoon in your hand because you were beginning to feed yourself, and you would drop the spoon over the table, and then mom or dad or someone else would pick up the spoon and put it back on the table, which you promptly dropped again over the table. And so in that instance, mom and dad is being played, but they know the importance of that game, and they would allow it to go for a while, and then they would get tired and put the spoon out of reach that you cannot touch the spoon. But at the same time, in our digital world, the moment you go on to Google server, for instance, you are being played because companies are building algorithms around you specifically, which they then sell to other companies to place custom ads on your screen. So nothing is free on the internet, really. Facebook is not free. Google is not free. Yahoo is not free. Twitter is not free. Ultimately, we are being played as we are commodified down the road. So it is a real area of discernment for me is, so if you play video games, how much do you play? When is it excessive play? How is the play impacting your life and your relationships? Most video games, the bad people are typically persons with darker skins. What will that do for our race relationships in this country? Women are almost always portrayed as sexual objects. What does that do around gender and identity for us? So I do have concern for how some games, not all games, but how some games, and they seem to be the most popular games, how they impact our lives.
Al, each of the as has become clear, I think, in the conversation, each of the chapters of your book discuss technology. But you have a chapter specifically devoted to what you call technological intelligence. So how does that differ from what you've been talking about? And what are some of the aspects of our technological world that such an intelligence has to address?
Yeah, technological intelligence is really key for us because we are immersed in this technological world. Technological intelligence takes the dictum by the historian of technology, Malvin Kranzberg, seriously. The dictum says, technology is neither good, nor is it bad, nor is it neutral. So if it's not good, nor bad, nor neutral, we are always impacted by technology. And I might say, hey, FaceTiming my family in Africa, that's the appropriate use of technology. But if my daughters are just upstairs in their bedroom, because they're teenagers, they don't want to come out of their bedroom, and suddenly I begin to FaceTime with them because we almost never have face-to-face conversation. I mean, you're smiling and laughing, but something would be off there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that might not be good use of technology. So I think technological intelligence speaks to a framework that you have by which you can discern whether this is appropriate. Is the source a good source, for instance? Is this helping me or hindering me? And I look at various areas of human nature. For instance, we as humans need wisdom to flourish in life much more than knowledge. Technology has placed knowledge at our fingertips because we can Google anything. So knowledge is right there. It's on hand, literally. But knowing stuff, even a lot of stuff, does not equate to being wise. Wisdom typically come after spending time with other people who are wiser than you are. That's how wisdom is cultivated. It's listening to stories over and over again. It's often tied to intergenerational contact. And so we certainly want to engage technology in such a way that we don't only get knowledge, which is important, but we need to find wisdom. At the same time, I address issues such as presence and co-presence as part of technological intelligence. So research on children tells us that when parents use technology in the presence of a child, that child almost always will feel that they are not important. That there's something on the screen or the laptop, there's something there that's more important than me, your child. And, I mean, isn't that a sad thing that we discover from children who will say that your piece of technology is more important than me? And how often does parents, for instance, handle technology in front of their kids? Happens a lot. So technology is neither good, nor bad, nor neutral, but it does mean we need to have some discernment system, which I think all of these intelligences that I try to flesh out helps us find. It helps give us a framework that we can make good choices even as we live with technology.
Now, a final question has to do with the theological aspect of your book. The subtitle of your book uses the word theology, and each chapter is also subtitled Toward a Theology of Something. The technological intelligence chapter, for example, is Toward a Theology of Discovery and Devices. But your introduction makes clear that, quote, that while, quote, growing down welcomes a constructive theological exploration of humanity's relationship with technology, it does not offer such a theology, unquote. And then in your conclusion, you reflect on how modern technology is caught up in the dynamics of memory and hope. As you write, quote, technology mimics the holding environment established between infants and children and their mothers, fathers, and primary caregivers, which is memory. And we hope for the reestablishment of a life-giving environment, reparation of wounds received, and a creative life, unquote. So these are some of the things you've been talking about. Memory and hope. It's hard not to hear echoes of previous theology centered around one or both of these concepts. Perhaps they would serve as well for the central elements in a theology of technology. What do you think?
I would agree with you, Chris. I really do. So I wrote the book as a psychologist of religion, coming more from psychology and sociology, anthropology, But one of my frustrations with the more traditional theologies around technology is that it basically does not take into consideration human nature. It is all about, for instance, I'm thinking of one source that I will not name. We were created, and then the fall of humanity happened, and now sin permeates the earth. So technology is also sinful, because we've created it in that image. Now, that is not the kind of argument that I'm interested in. I'm interested in how are we shaped? How are we engaging? How do we need to engage so that we can live flourishing lives? So the memory and the hope for me is really important. I do think all of us, even if it's just a body memory and not a conscious memory, we remember being held by parents and loved ones. We remember being cared. And we absolutely long, or the language that I use, we hope to retrieve some of that. I'm thinking of research that indicates how lonely people have become with technology. They are connected, yes, but they're actually also extremely lonely because there's no people in their lives. And so I'm thinking of a theology of hope such as Jürgen Moltmann's theology of hope. And I'm thinking specifically of his concept of the eschatological self, which is a wonderful concept that he writes about in God in Creation, a theology of creation and the Spirit of God. So in God in Creation, Moltmann says, the eschatological self, which is the self that is always becoming, you can hear the transformation right there, the self that's always becoming, lives on basically two planes of existence. And the first one he calls the futurum. And the futurum is basically our future that we expect. It's our calendar. I mean, for you and me, our calendars are populated a year to 2 years in advance now with conferences and events, and we know what's coming way out there. So that's the futurum. And then Moltmann says, but there's another plane of existence, and he calls those Adventus moments. And Adventus moments would be those moments where God actually breaks into your reality and something, almost like a Kairos moment, and something brand new, unexpected, happens right in your midst. And Moltmann then says, if you live too futurum-oriented, you will miss all the Adventus moments in your life. To use different language, if we live busy lives, which most of us live, the sacred or the divine will be rarely experienced in our day-to-day living. So I'm thinking that, drawing on Moltmann's work, Moltmann will say probably something like this: limit your time on technology, and you may even want to take a technology Sabbath every now and then, maybe once a week, so that you can open yourself up for Adventus moments, because that is what will give you hope in life. Reading a news feed is not going to give you hope in life.
Probably the opposite.
But it is, exactly. There's a good likelihood that it will fill you with despair. So I want to really encourage folk, scholars especially, to think deeply about a theology of technology. But in doing so, they have to marry at least three things. What we read about humans in Scripture, that's one thing. What we've discovered about humanity through psychology and neuroscience, sociology, anthropology, bring that into the conversation, and then certainly bring into conversation technology, how it's been created, how technology assists us, creates enormous potential. I mean, I couldn't imagine even writing this book on a typewriter. It's just not even possible. How technology is wonderful, But remember, it's not good, nor bad, nor neutral. So how will it impact our lives?
Great. Thank you again, Jaco, for this conversation.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate all your work that you've put into making this possible. Thanks.
Thank you. Again, I've been talking with Jaco Hammann, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, Growing Down, Theology and Human Nature in the Virtual Age, published by Baylor University Press. If you have any questions about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.